everyone. This is Cameron Esposito, and welcome to Earwolf Presents, featuring an episode of my show, Query. Well, actually, it's two episodes, sort of Frankensteined together. Well, Frankenstein's the doctor, not the monster. I guess this is the monster. March is Women's History Month, and to celebrate, this is an episode featuring Glennon Doyle and Abby Wambach. I love both of them. They're good friends of mine, but also Glennon is one of the most successful nonfiction writers in the last couple of years. And Abby is the greatest soccer player of all time. Like, literally, more goals in international play than anyone else. I love these two, and they are also strong female leaders. They lead by example. They are cool as hell. And I can't wait for you to find out more about them. You can check out my show, Query, on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. I've been feeling wrong, but I'm still holding on. Darling, I know it's careless. On this show, I always have folks introduce themselves. Would you introduce yourself?
Well, I might be the first guest you've ever had that got a text message from her manager with my own bio for this very moment. And I just want to make it known to your followers and your listeners that I am not reading this. This is off the top of my head from my memory.
I mean, all right, yeah. Let's go. Let's hear that off the cuff intro.
So my name is Abby Wambach. You may know me from the time that I played soccer for the United States for many years. It felt like centuries. It felt like such a long, fun, amazing career. I've got a couple gold medals. I've got World Cup championship. I've written a couple books now. One is coming out in April. Check it out. It's called Wolfpack. But I think the thing that I'm most proud of is that I am what I call the wife of Glennon Doyle. my wife is amazing, and she has really brought me back to life in a lot of ways. So that's the thing that I kind of attach myself to the most, and the thing I'm maybe most proud of.
There's so many cool things to discuss in that very off-the-cuff intro. But I want to start, Abby, by... I got a chance to meet you. We did some live shows together for part of something that's called...
You're so funny, by the way. You are so funny. Like, you're brilliant, but you're just... Your timing. Can I swear on this?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, your timing is so on point, and you're funny, and I feel like we see the world very similarly, so all of your jokes really landed on me.
Oh, thank you for saying that. You know, I don't know what it's like for you. I'll say, when you started talking, I was like, oh my God, humiliating. I think she's about to give me a compliment. Like, my shoulders changed. I'm just like, oh, like, how am I going to survive this?
You did it.
Yeah,
good job.
I did it. Well, I got to the other side. I had a lot of fun with those shows that we did. It's a group of people, and I was the only stand up on the dates that we did, and that's like a very fun situation for me to do stand up in, because I feel like I actually like that vibe, standing up, like getting up in the middle of some folks who are funny but maybe not telling jokes specifically, because I feel like I'm like, oh man, if you liked those witticisms, you're going to love these jokes that have been crafted over years, you know?
Yeah, it's like it's a perfect platform for you to just crush. Right?
That's
like,
exactly what I'm saying, yes.
Because we actually brought a real comic and put a real comic like yourself on stage. You know, the Together Tour is what we actually first met doing. It's one of those things that I feel really proud of. I've been a part of it for a few years now, and my wife is actually the co-creator of it. And the whole idea was to get women, however you identify yourself, to be celebrated and to celebrate from different walks of life, from different artists and industries. So you yourself found yourself to be the actual comedian. I try to be funny. My jokes don't land like yours do, but it was really fun to be able to share the stage with you and to see how real comedians actually work.
Well, what I also took away was watching, you know, I don't know how, I would imagine that for you, that is like such a monumental shift. I mean, I know that in your, well, I don't know. I would guess that in like your role as a leader on your team, and then also as somebody who is so famous for the sport that they played, that you had to speak in front of people a lot. But was that often live?
Like I imagine, you know, you're like, you have a lot of experience on TV. You have a lot of experience in the spotlight. Do you have a lot of experience speaking in front of large groups of people live?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. That's a good question, because I think what I was able to do on the field gave me a platform off the field. And I think that you probably can understand this, that what your craft is, right? What you're good at, what you are probably most known for in the world of women, that we can't be one dimensional in a lot of ways. And I think especially at the early stages of women in sport, you know, 40 years ago, Title IX happened. And it was one of those, it's been a long period of time that women have had to continually fight for what we currently now have. And so I knew at a certain point in my career, I had to develop, not a speaking ability, but the ability to get up and to tell our story. And I think that's,
I never thought of that, Abby, till this moment, till you just said that to me.
Yeah. And honestly, I think that many women probably don't understand that they've been having to do 17 different things to enable them to do their one craft, right? You know, men don't have that same pressure or responsibility. And that is part of the long fight that women are continually having to go on. And these requirements that it takes for a woman to actually be successful is outrageous. So the idea for me to get up and speak, my hope is that one day, you know, that next player who retires won't need to have that same skill set that covers this wide range. Because some people are stage fright. Some people are terrified getting up in front. Some people aren't eloquent. Some people don't like that. Some people just want to play their sport or just do comedy, you know, and they should be able to do that. So it's going to take some more time, I think. But, you know, it's not lost on me that I was lucky to be able to get on stage and to have confidence on stage. And then have a story to tell, like have a message. That's also kind of important.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think about that in my own job, of course, because I've lived my job. You know, I know the things that I had to do that are tangential to my specialty. And I like it, and I think that there are some benefits. But I think you pointing out the... Like, of course this is true, and I think I've probably even said this, but the pressure on women in your field to, like, explain the job that they're doing as they do it. Like, that's what it feels like in comedy a lot. Sometimes I get this question a little bit less, but I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago, every interview would include, like, what's it like being a woman in comedy? And so it's just a lot of energy to have to explain what you're doing as you're doing it. And I think that's a little bit what you're talking about too. And
yeah. And it's frustrating because, you know, you spend 10 minutes explaining what a woman's place is in comedy or in sport. And, you know, my future wish for, you know, the next generation of women athletes and women comedians is that they don't have to waste any freaking time explaining what it's like to be a woman in comedy or a woman in sport. They're just an athlete or they're just a comedian. Like, let's drop stupid pronouns that people can't understand. We're freaking human beings. We go through the same stuff. We travel, we sacrifice, we train, we blood, sweat, and tears the exact same. So, you know, that's kind of my mission over the rest of my life. I've kind of made a new career for myself, trying to make sure that the people who come behind me don't struggle in the same ways that I did and maybe the same ways that you did.
Was it always soccer for you? Like, you're a little kid. What were you playing as a little kid?
I was playing anything that could get me attention, right? Like, so I still am a total attention whore. My wife says that I'm competing with the 10-year-old, our 10-year-old daughter. Or who gets, she's like, you're actively trying to get more attention than the child, the youngest child in our family. Like, I don't know what that means, but yeah, I was always a really great athlete. And I think that gave me a sense of confidence, a sense of self, and an ability that not everybody else had. So it gave me that, I think, that other element that some people have inside of them to kind of continue to pursue that elusive dream of whether it be playing in the Olympics or whatever it is, your end dream goal, like the best thing that could ever happen in the thing that you love to do. And I grew up in a huge family. I was the youngest of seven. So watching my brothers and sisters play sports, you know, I just kind of always had this knowing that, like, oh, I'm going to be able to do that a little bit better than them.
Are they athletic? Like, did they have sport career? Even in, like, you know, high school, college sort of a thing, did they play sports?
Yeah. My sister Beth actually went to Harvard and played basketball at Harvard. She was one of the number one 3-point shooters in the country at one point in college. That was a very big claim to fame in my family until, of course, I went to college and started winning national championships and stuff.
Eat it, Beth.
My other sister, she played soccer at Xavier University.
Oh, that's where my parents went and met.
No way.
Yeah, no, for real. Yeah, my parents went to Xavier and met there.
That's amazing. Yeah. I think have they ever been to, what is it called? It's not Six Flags. Is it Six Flags?
Oh, Cedar Point. I don't know. I'm naming places that are in Ohio. I have no idea.
Well, it was like an amusement park that had this really crazy big Kings Island.
That's oh, sure. Yes, they've been to Kings Island.
Yeah, that huge. I went there when I visited my sister. It's all I remember about Xavier. But yeah, I came from a really athletic family. My brothers played sports all through high school, and then kind of went to work for my dad, and went to college, and never really pursued it beyond that. So I was lucky. I was lucky to be involved in a family that was very sports centric and valued sport. Given that I ended up doing it as a profession.
Yeah. What about your parents? Did they have some natural athleticism or any? I mean, I'm imagining like what you telling me those facts. The context that's giving me is that you weren't even like the first woman in your family to have. To play at a college level, that's extremely unusual. And then especially like in the time when you and I were growing up, because like now, like, I mean, this is still true now, and it was more true then. And this is not, there's not a huge gap between now and then in terms of time. Right.
But yeah, well, my dad was a super athlete. He was really quick, fast. I think he ran track and he played football and wrestled. But after high school, went to go work for his father. My great grandfather and grandfather had like a farm stand, like a little farm stand, and then it turned into a farm. So my dad took over that business and never got to kind of see the fruits of his sporting labor. So I think that he lived quite vicariously through his daughters, which is so evident in the way that all of my sister Beth and Laura and myself were very independent and were very strong. And my dad will take complete credit for that. but I have to be honest and kind of give most of the credit to my mom. You know, being a wife back in the, back in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, she was a stay-at-home mom, raised us Catholic. So she had a unique set of value systems in place. And I think one thing that she really wanted us to break free from, is this whole idea that we needed to be reliant on a man to be happy. You know, and I think that was something all of us really took seriously. My mom always told me, you know, you need to make your own money and you need to put yourself in a position where you're not, you know, serving only somebody else. Like, you have to take care of yourself. So I learned those real values, and I think my eldest sister is a doctor and now actually doesn't practice anymore and is the mother of six children. And then my next sister, Laura, she's a teacher. So, you know, I think my parents did a really good job of raising us, and they are not without fault. You know, I mean, God love them. They did the very, very best that they could. But I think, you know, they really did put inside of us girls an idea, a value system of independence. And that really has kind of been with me throughout my life.
Do you know where your mom got that idea? Like, I think about, you know, her telling you t- to make your own money or something like that. That's like a radical concept.
Yeah. She got still it because now. I think she was pissed at having to ask my dad for money. You know?
Fair enough. Yeah, that's a very good cause and effect.
She worked as hard as he did, right? He would go to work in the morning and come home, and she had seven children to deal with. And a lot of people out there would say she worked 10 times harder than he did because he wasn't dealing with little humans running around and making a mess of everything. So, you know, I think that anger probably is a huge marker for her that allows her to make decisions and allowed her to treat us and to parent us and guide us in a kind of a, like you put it in your words, radical way.
Well, this is all like, I mean, I can relate to a ton of the stuff that you're saying. You know, I was raised really Catholic. My dad always wanted to be a singer, and then, you know, he's a lawyer. So it's definitely, there was a time when I lived in Chicago, and that's where he lives, when I used to set up shows where my little sister's also a singer, and my family would, I would throw these like, Italian-themed shows where my family would come and be backup singers for me. And by the way, just so you know, they love this job. And, you know, it's a very specific thing having, you know, in my case, I'll say, having, like, my dad made all these choices to work hard to, like, further our social standing and, like, send me to private school, things like that. Like send me to Catholic school. Like to, you know, he worked his ass off to like shoveling asphalt to put himself through law school so that he could send me to Catholic school, which like, honestly, pretty sure that wasn't worth it. But, and then, you know, so that then I could like turn around and like live the dream that he never got to live. I mean, there's I have a lot of feelings about this.
It feels so like law, like there was so much lost along the way, them trying to do right by us. But we have to remember, and this is something I have continually come back to, and especially with my relationship with my parents and my mom, you know, it wasn't easy coming out to them. It wasn't easy getting them to understand that I was going to do what I wanted to do, whether or not they believed it to be sin or whatever it was. Like I always have to keep reminding myself that our parents are good people, and they were doing what they felt was best at the time, because we have to remind ourselves that like it's easy, like hindsight is 20/20, right? And it's easy to look back on the history and the story of our lives and point out all the things that went wrong and point blame to our parents for putting us in these crazy positions. But at the time, they were really truly feeling and thinking that that it was the best decision for us. Now, if they could go back and change things now, knowing who we've turned into, of course I think that they probably would make different choices. But they were assuming at the time that we were going to turn into what would be quote unquote your average normal human being, right? And I think that is really important for parents out there when they're making certain decisions about how to guide their children through their lives, is you always have to remember that your kid could be of that's however small percent it could, your kid could be trans, your kid could be bi, your kid could be homosexual, whatever it is, whatever marginalized group, you have to remember that it's possible. So you never want to have your children unlearn stuff that you force them to learn as a child.
Yeah, that's real. I mean, when did that happen for you? When did you come out to your folks? Like just general age range?
I was 22. I told my mom, I took her to a Mexican restaurant because I felt like I got to do this in public for some reason.
Oh, I did it at the Nordstrom Cafe, but it wasn't my mom asked me. But anyway, yes. Public, the Nordstrom Cafe, tuna sandwiches. Keep going.
I came out with it in the most strong way. Like, you know me a little bit. Like, I'm just like, my personality is like, I am basically all or nothing. So I wasn't going to like whimper into the conversation. I didn't want her to have any reason to doubt what I was saying. So I basically said to her, Mom, I need to tell you something. I am a lesbian. So I used the strongest word that you can use that makes it, you know, undeniable to hear. And she, of course, you know, she did her very best under the circumstances. I think my mom has had known for a long time, but her belief system made it harder for her to hear those words, right? So she told me a few times, like, no, you're not. No, you're not. No, you're not. And, you know, 10 years later, I had to come out again and remind her I still am a lesbian, you know, Ma. And it was kind of our little secret that we didn't share with the rest of the family. Although I told my brothers and sisters and they were like, yeah, cool. We've known forever. Right. You know? So yeah, that was when I was 22. And then I think maybe when I was 29, like 7 or 8 years later, I had to, you know, remind her that this was still the case and things had not changed. And this was my life.
When 22, what was going on in the rest of your life at that time? Like, I'm trying to timestamp. Like, were you out of what was going on for you?
I had just left college to enter into the Women's Professional Soccer League. It was then called the WSA, and there's been a few iterations since. In 2003 is when I started to get more. Invitations to play on the national team. In 2004, I was mostly a mainstay on the national team. So once the national team stuff started to happen, then it was real easy to sweep my sexuality under the rug and not talk about it, because I had this other massive focal point that I could continue to relate with my parents around.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and if I were to be able to go back in time, I would do things differently because, you know, that was also me not wanting to actually deal with the relationship that I was trying to cultivate with my parents. And so it's taken, you know, 15 or 20 years to actually have these hard conversations. And, you know, being brought up Catholic, I was, and I've just figured this out. My struggle was I felt like at the time I was having to decide between my mom and God or myself. And, you know, up until 6 months ago, I'm almost 39. So up until 6 months ago, I had this revelation like, oh, actually God is not separate than me. And God is not separate than my mom. And God is not the church, right? So I had been feeling like this guilt, you know, this Catholic guilt that we're all made to fear and feel less than and shame about myself. And I was just getting it really mixed up. So I'm glad that I cleared that up. And it's actually allowed me to have a little bit of healing with my relationship with my mom because, you know, she's getting older and I don't want to have things that are left unsaid. So, you know, for all of your listeners, having the hard conversations now will... First of all, save the conversation for, you know, you're just saving the conversation for later or worst case scenario, you won't ever have it. And then, you know, God knows what happens after that. So have the hard conversations with your parents or your family now and get them to see you and get them to hear what you want to say because you're going to have to say it eventually. Might as well just get it over with, eat the frog.
Yeah, I mean, there's a particular set of circumstances, though, that to what you're talking about. I was a little younger. I was, but not much. I was 19, but a lot of things were different between what you're describing and my situation. I was, you know, still in college that my folks were helping me pay for, and it was a Catholic college. And so I was still getting messaging there. Like you couldn't come out. You could be kicked out of school. And, so like for me, that actually, to your point, it did sort of force me to have, well, first of all, I'll say this. Sometimes it's just like straight up not safe to have some of these conversations. But you're talking about when it's safe, but you're just making a choice or whatever. And I get that. I think because of the specifics of what I'm talking about, I did have to have those conversations like very
in a very focused way, just because I didn't have this other thing going on, or like a job or something else that was pulling me in a different direction. I had to just like kind of work it out with them over you know, from like 19 to 25.
And you were in a controlled environment too, because mm-hmm. you were asking them for their resources to go to this crazy college that's not allowing you to actually be yourself because of their belief system. So and I understand every situation is very different. Obviously, safety is the number one priority, but yeah, that's hard. And I'm glad that you had those conversations, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of compassion for you, because like the pressure cooker of all of that kind of just, you know, you're right. Like it did, like by the time I was 25, I was living back in Chicago and dating a woman that they liked. And it was just like, okay, now you have to get over this now. Like it was such a finite amount of time because it was so big. And I'm imagining like in your case, yeah, that's a long time to sort of carry that like dance that you're doing, where, because I certainly did that during that time, you know, like there was a, you know, I went home for Thanksgiving and didn't bring my partner or brought somebody in. She was my friend, you know, like I did that all, but it was all just very condensed. And I certainly know how stressful that is to try to figure out like sort of who can hear what about your life, like who in your life can hear what things about your life. That compartmentalization is it's so isolating. And I just have a lot of compassion for what I'm assuming you must have been going through at that time, which is a lot of like redirecting towards soccer or whatever.
I think that also added a layer of pressure to the whole thing, because I started to get a little bit more famous. My name was a little bit more out there. And so, you know, my mom at one point just begged me not to come out publicly. You know, and it's this whole idea of perception and the way that the outside world perceives your family and the way that I was raised and how that's going to now reflect on my parents. So I have compassion for my mom also. But here's the thing, you know, it became this pressure cooker, and that kind of led me down a really difficult path towards the end of my career. And a lot of things were kind of coming to a head for me, and I was really struggling with alcohol and prescription pills. And so that was the other side of it, where I was placating and wanting my mom's security and acceptance. While all the while not listening to my own needs. And so I went the opposite direction and started making bad choices for my personal life, for my personal body. And so I think that there has to be the balance of, and protection, that there has to be protection in place for you and yourself that, is long-term, right?
Yeah.
As soon as I started to struggle, you know, as soon as I actually started struggling, and then, you know, when the shit actually hit the fan, I got a DUI, like my life completely changed because I got sober and I was able to actually have these hard conversations. I was actually able to create boundaries and create a life for myself that felt really good because of my gayness, not in spite mm-hmm. of my. And I think that I needed to get to that point, unfortunately. I needed to get so low that I just had nothing else but needing, but the requirement of accepting who I was and accepting of what the life I wanted, and then go out and create it. So, you know, as much as I would love to sit here and blame my parents for every little thing that ever went wrong in my life, like I am here now, because of them, right? Like some of that struggle, though it was hard and though it was very real, has allowed me to get stronger in ways that I wouldn't have. Right. And so it's not all for naught. Right. Like, and I understand too, that everybody's story is different and everybody's pain is different and everybody's reaction to it is different. But for me, I want to be the narrator of my story. And in order to do that, I have to take control of all the aspects of it And I don't want to blame. I don't want to give out any of the power that I've been able to curate for myself and create for myself. So I want to take that on myself and I guess be the strongest dyke I can be.
Yes, be the strongest dyke you can be.
I always have guests introduce themselves. Would you introduce yourself?
My name is Glennon Doyle. Am I supposed to say other things or just my name?
That's what's kind of fun about it. It's choose your own adventure about, you know, like some people just say their name and other people might want to include certain things in how they describe themselves or how they introduce themselves. I just mean like it literally could be like your who you are as a human in your personal life, who you are in a human in your business life. It's a fun
name. I don't
feel
like saying those things.
You know what?
I just feel like saying I'm Glennon Doyle and I'm pretty sure about that.
Well, that's actually, watch as I grab my chest. Well, some stuff that I can fill in is that folks are not going to be able to see this, but I can see that you are sitting in front of a blown up cover of your most recent book, Untamed. Mm-hmm. And I also look at this. Wow. Now it's also on your screen looking back at you. Here's the copy that you sent me. And Untamed is a book that was released during these pandemic times. I know that you had begun just the very first steps of your book tour and then bagged a bunch of cities because it was an ever-changing landscape. I think you were 2 weeks ahead of me in terms of beginning touring stuff. So you had done a few things. And the amazing thing, you know, is that the book was a number one bestseller, is, you know, doing performing phenomenally, like in print space, in audio. Like it's really been a huge success during the time. It's the Reese's Book Club pick. Mm-hmm. But I guess I wanted to start by asking you, it struck me when I was thinking about today that you're actually somebody who has done a bunch of pivoting throughout your time as a business human. So yes, you had to pivot at the very beginning of a book tour, but I also just happen to know that you're even somebody who like started in a blogging space and then had to transition into, okay, now I'm a writer that writes books. Okay, now I'm a writer that writes books, but I also appear in public. Mm-hmm. And just like for me right now, I'm really struggling with the additional pivoting, even though I'm a person who's pivoted in the past. How are you doing with that?
I mean, that's how I should have introduced myself.
Dory.
Glennon Doyle. Pivoter.
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 But like
permanent pivoter. I mean, Cameron, not only that, but listen, okay. So I have three books out, right?
Yes.
But my first book was about, you know, basically like how to get, it was a memoir. It was how I got sober and created my little family, right?
Yes.
And then a few weeks before I went on tour with that book, my ex-husband now, my then husband, told me that he'd been cheating on me our whole marriage. Okay. So I, right before that book tour, okay, so I had to go out and do that book tour immediately following that imploding news. Okay. Then my second book, Love Warrior, was about the recovering of that marriage, okay? The redemption. Like it was being touted all over the place as a marriage redemption story.
Right.
And then a few weeks before the release of that book, I fell madly in love with Abby. Okay?
Abby Wambach, who is your wife, that has also been a guest on this podcast. Query.
Yes, who is our, yes. And so, I did an interview right before this release where the woman said to me, what do you think is going to happen at this book tour time? I was like, oh, global pandemic. It's my fucking fault. It's my fault. So, we were on the road, and it was kind of early on, like people weren't making full-on decisions yet. It was just like a weird time. Should we go? Should we not? Like, it feels weird. And Abby was actually the one, our whole team was sitting around just gathering, what do we do? What do we do? And she actually was like, this isn't the right thing. It isn't the right thing.
Something I just want to acknowledge that is super interesting to me is like, because of the specificity of your, where you came from as an artist, you know, somebody who started in a, like, talking about parenting from a like Christian heterosexual perspective, mm-hmm. I have seen the audience that you draw, and it is a really different audience than self-selects to my shows. By the way, like, I do really well with your audience. I'm sure you do really well with my mm-hmm. audience. It's just that, like, we actually don't get to pick who buys tickets to see us. That is a really interesting part of thinking about this book coming out Untamed, and like thinking about you being, you know, more public with your relationship with Abby, even during this time, because it's like so much of what you're showing is sort of your household right now. Mm-hmm. And you just have this audience that, like, again, that's who I started. When I started in stand up, you know, you start with everybody. That's who I started with, was sort of a straight audience or whatever. But it wasn't necessarily as dominated by women, because comedy self-selects male a little bit. I guess I just, what you're able to do and who you're able to bring in is fascinating to me. I'm wondering, like, how much you think about that. I'm sure it's a lot. Like, who you are talking to might actually be mm-hmm. different than who I'm talking to. We have different mm-hmm. Readerships, and mm-hmm. you know, you saying that story, it's like, I can so relate to it. Maybe some straight women have never heard that before, that are buying tickets to your mm-hmm. show because they're mm-hmm. somebody who identifies as a Christian, and they also love that you're funny and fun. Mm-hmm. What is that like as a responsibility? Yeah, often is that in your mind?
Oh, constantly. I mean, it was certainly in my mind right before Love Warrior came out, and mm-hmm. I told my team that I was going to announce that I was leaving my husband and marrying Abby. And everyone thought that, I mean, my team, a very important person on my team, turned to me and said, you can do this, but this will be career suicide. It will be over. You can't, they will not accept this. Like, this is, so that was interesting. I mean, I just had this serious hunch that was not true, that people are a little bit better than we give them credit for. And that, I mean, not fundamentalist Christians. They're not necessarily better than we give them credit for.
Heard.
Right. I'm serious. Like, I mean, but like the freaking, I mean, Cameron, after that time, there were entire, like, I would open up the internet and there would be official, like, whatever this means, like, official letters of entire denominations excommunicating me from their denomination publicly. But like, I wasn't even part of their denomination. Like, I felt like Kramer from Seinfeld, where he's like, you can't fire me. I don't even work here. Like, what is happening? Right? So there was some of that. But I don't know. What I feel like with my audience that sometimes makes me sad is how long and involved I've been in anti-racist movements, and how freaking white my audience is. That sometimes surprises me. But then I always think, okay, it's not my job to get Black women to listen to me. It's my job to get white women to listen to Black women. Right?
Yeah.
So then I just try to use that time to like point to other people. But yeah, I mean, my audience is largely, I mean, Abby calls it soccer mom land. You know, which, you know, those women have a serious place to play in this world, and they have been relentlessly supportive of me and Abby. And what sometimes I think it's so interesting, because sometimes I think the best work that Abby and I can do in that lane with my people, it's never like my speeches or my activism, although that helps. It's like me showing little videos of Abby and I cooking. It's like, everyone's like, oh my God, that's like us. You know?
I do know, actually. So I really know. I really, really know from, you know, lived experience. I too have wondered the same thing. I guess I want to ask you about how it would feel emotionally. A couple years ago, I took a photograph of, there were these dudes in my neighborhood, my old neighborhood, who would put up a nativity set, one of those plastic light up nativity sets. It had two Josephs because they were gay dudes. I took a photograph of this. I put it on my own Instagram. And it went viral on Facebook to the degree that the Archbishop of Rhode Island put out an official statement about my photo and how it, you know, disparaged the Holy Family. And I just, like, first, in some ways, this was actually, like, appreciated, because I had not been going to Catholic services. You know, I had not been, I assumed correctly that since I had been checking, like, look, I would look in, you know, checking at the Pope. Okay, he's like a little bit okay on environmental issues. Does he think women aren't people still? Yes. Does he still think I'm inherently going to hell? 100%. Okay, well then, like, just checked in and then I popped back out. So it was actually helpful to get this direct statement so that I could remember where the church's priorities continue to lie. Like, great point. Like, on the list of priorities, like, this is, you know, this plastic light up nativity has to be up there amongst the top. Yes. So I just felt like fantastic. But it hurt me personally, because I'm like, gee, like, I'm just like, this is like, ah, like, I'm still a person that took a photo I was excited about. So how do you, like, as a human, how do you hold that space for that? How do you, like, how do you hold space for being excommunicated by the denominations you're not a part of? What do you do with that?
Well, I mean, you know what we do. We do humor.
Yes.
Like, what the fuck? We do therapy.
Yes.
We do
humor. Yes.
I mean, I don't know. Listen, here's some good news. Let me tell you this news, okay? Since the day Untamed came out, it has been number one on Amazon in Christian self-help.
I did see this.
Cameron, I don't care about anything else. All I do is check Amazon relentlessly to make sure it's still number one Christian self-help. Okay, so I don't know what that's about. It makes me so excited to think of all those Christians just buying the gay book. I don't know. It's hopeful to me. And if nothing else, it's completely hilarious. But I think, like, look, Abby and I have this thing going on where it's like, do we hate religion? Do we love religion? Do we hate faith? I think we actually really, really both deeply have this weird faith. But it's like you have this thing inside of you that's like a spark, or like this thing that swells inside of you that has something to do with God or the divine, or I don't know, it's something that's just bigger than you. And then when you're little, you go to religion. It makes me feel like it's like having an artist spark inside of you and then going to a class where somebody sits you down and they're like, color inside these lines. And if you don't color inside these lines, you will be hurt and I will smack you and I will shame you for the rest of your life. And that is art. Right?
Yes.
So then after a while, you're so traumatized and you're so shamed and you have been so mistreated that you think you're not an artist. But you were always an artist. You just got this really horrible, bad class on this shit. And these people that were teaching it had no idea what they were talking about. And, like, for me, the fact that I'll tell you, this is what I think is inexcusable. Okay. I find it completely inexcusable that any parent with the level of consciousness we should have right now, okay, would put their children in those sort of shaming, traumatizing religious experiences. That is something that's very hard for me to stomach as a mother, as a human being. And the funny thing is, you know, since I'm in this space of like the Venn diagram of like faith person and whatever I am, like it's in a same gender marriage, I don't know what I am actually, but people write to me all the time about these, you know, their kids coming out and they've been in churches and they've been in whatever, and they're so sad now because their kids have been listening to this shit forever from the pulpits, and then they come out and it's too effing late. Like, it's too late to wait until your kid is or isn't. So then what? You go and try to, you know, real quick bandage up the scars that this kid has been suffering with alone forever. It's too late. I mean, you can try, but like those God wounds, they take forever. I mean, Abby, so for a while, we figured out maybe like a year ago that, okay, how do I explain this? Abby's like furiously mad at a God she doesn't believe in.
Yeah.
Which is a difficult place to be.
Yeah.
In. Right? So, which I was trying to like dissect with her the idea that if you're really furious at something, you probably have some idea that it exists. Right? And so what we figured out is that she, at a very young age, she, as a little gay kid in a Catholic church, she felt like she was given a choice, right? That she could choose God and church and her mom, or she could choose herself, right? And she chose herself, and her selfness, keeping her selfness, has required her to spend her whole life saying, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you to God, right? That is, I'm proud of her. Like, that is what it took. And but the thing that I think is true is that I don't think that at a young age she chose herself instead of God and church. I feel certain that she chose herself and God instead of church, right? That she was unbelievably wise and spiritual at a very young age and figured out, actually, this church stuff is horseshit and I'm going to die if I believe in it. But I just feel like there's a difference between believing in church and believing in God.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I ask about this because I hear, especially since releasing this book, but like I just hear about this anyway, because it's, I do talk so much about the, you know, the fact that I wanted to be a priest. And one thing that strikes me as always strange is when I will post something sort of about maybe a little bit more in the category that you're talking about of like, it's a spirituality thing. It's like a spirit thing. And, invariably, someone will in the comments put direct folks to a denomination or a church that they think supports queer folks or that they experience as supporting queer folks. And I have to remember like that it's not always about me, even if it is my platform, because my response to that, just on an emotional level, is usually just like, get the fuck out of here with this. Like, for me, I am not able to be there. I felt so hurt and disappointed when I saw that the faith that I was like, not just like raised in, but like committed to as an access point to the divine was actually a corporation that seals its wealth through patriarchy, colonialism, and abuse. I was literally like, wait, what? Like, and I get that some people always knew this. Like, I get that some people knew this about the church the whole time. For me, I literally was reading the, you know, documents as a theology major, and I was going, wait, like, literally, like, wait, what? You know, like, it would, to me, it was a full stop, shocking moment. And so I just have this sort of, you know, I just don't think, Like, I'm not there yet. Maybe someday I'll be there, but I'm not there yet where I'm like, I just, every denomination feels like a fucking Scooby-Doo villain where I'm like, just the masks are going to come off. And that's not, there are queer people who do the work. You know, there are people I trust who do the work, who work in a pastoral sense. That, for me, that is not, I cannot go back there right now. And it's fucking done for me.
Well, I feel the same way. And I have no idea whether whether that will change.
Yeah.
You know, I'm open to that changing. But I also feel like I know too much.
Please make me wrong on this. Please present, not you, but the universe. Please present, the thing. But it's just not there for me right now. I also want to, because I just keep taking little notes on things I want to make sure to cover. Okay, so we got God a little bit. Well, I'm sure we'll come back. It's actually part of all of this. You were talking about the feeling of the drugs involved with love. And, another thing that I have said for years, because people will ask me, like, they'll try to talk to me after I'm on stage. And I have to say to people, like, I'm very strange right now. I am on drugs. I'm experiencing drugs in my body because, like, the amount of adrenaline and, like, endorphins mm-hmm. that I have currently, right? Like I'll do a meet and greet after, and I'm trying so hard to have, like, a normal face because
normal.
I just know that I need to, like, witness this person who's in front of me, but I'm, like, absolutely jumping out of my skin. And, mm-hmm. As somebody who, like, you have such a strong presence on stage. You're so good at it. Is that something that you thought would be part of writing for you? Like, did you think, and then this will lead to I'm on stage?
No. And I'm going to tell you, Cameron, that it thoroughly pissed me off at first because truly, and I've talked to other writers who feel kind of felt this way. Like, it feels like the Scooby-Doo thing. Like, you think you're a writer, but here's actually what you have to do. Like, so truly what, I'm a serious introvert. As a matter of fact, on day 20 of quarantine, Abby turned to me on the couch and goes, has your life changed at all?
No.
So I really, when I found writing and when I found writing that could happen on the interwebs, mm-hmm. I thought I had found the magical thing, right? Like, here's the thing where I can actually be honest. It felt very much to me, the way that I wrote and elicited responses from people felt to me kind of like an A meeting. It was like an A meeting I could do at home. It felt safe. I could talk about, like the importance of community without ever having to get together with anyone. And then this thing happens with writing, and I don't think it's always been a thing, but it was, now you've got to go become a commercial for your book. Like, you are now a commercial for your book. It's nice that you made that thing, but that was just the first part of your job. And now you have to become a commercial for the art you made, which, by the way, is a whole different skill set.
Yes.
Right? It's like you're a baker. And then they're like, and just real quick, you have to be a Navy SEAL. Like, they're unrelated and require different constitutions. Okay?
Yeah.
So what you have to do. Anyway, so Cameron, I think I told you this story before.
I do think I know what's coming next, but I would love to. I think the podcast audience needs to hear it. Yes, continue.
Needs to hear that for my first maybe 10 speaking engagements, I made my sister sit behind me in a chair on stage and say no words and say nothing. And I never explained what she was doing then. So, Cameron, I still have people come up to me and be like, you're so good at this now. Like, I came to see you once and there was a woman on stage and it was like, it was so weird. It was like we were doing a panel, but only one of us. So I'm just telling you that story to explain how stressful it was for me, and slowly I just started doing it the way I do everything else. Just like, well, first of all, I figured out that I didn't have to do like a fancy version of speaking. Like, I didn't have to do the thing where I stand up and I say a speech. Okay, I can't do that. You've seen me. I can't speak while I'm standing. You blow my mind. I don't know how you do it. You walk. You
I got talk, standing and speaking.
Stand.
I got them too.
Freaking crazy! Yeah. It's crazy. I bring a chair. I've never spoken without a chair. I sit down. I have to sit. I know my boundaries. Okay. And yeah, I feel like I'm good at it now. It's taken me a long time, but I feel like I'm good at translating my writing voice to the stage. Right. Yeah. But Cameron, it's if someday I'll sit down and show you what I go through to give a speech, and it's ridiculous. I mean, when I sit on a stage and talk and everyone's like, oh, it's just so impromptu and you just sound like you're so natural. I have memorized every freaking word that I'm going to say. It's pain. That's how I manage my anxiety about speaking. So I write everything out and then I speak the entire thing into an iPhone. And then I listen to all the things so many times. Sometimes, Cameron, I give the speeches to my dog in my bathroom. So I have to do a lot of things to be a freaking clinically anxious motivational speaker.
Can you feel,
it's not easy.
Can you feel the audience being there when
yes.
you're doing it?
It's my church now.
When you feel that, can you be with them? Or like, do you need to be on your own script inside of you?
No, the only time that I mess, like I get really anxious and terrible and sweat and mess up, I guess what I would call mess up, which is just like lose my way, is when I try to stick too much to the thing inside, like mm-hmm. the thing I've memorized. So I have to do the thing where I prepare the living hell out of it and then get on stage and just completely let go of it, which is a very
yeah.
weird thing.
That actually makes all the sense in the world to me. You know, I asked you a bunch of these questions and it's like, it's funny. It does feel it's so specific to being a writer right now, but it also is not, because I feel that more than ever before, sort of anybody in any field is being called to do this double duty of like, we also are the brand that's representing the, you know, the job that we do for so many people. And it is very strange. You know, I feel this way too, that there's just a lot of extra work in terms of learning that is required right now, because we are not necessarily at a time of specialists. We're more at a time of everybody has to be a jack of all trades. So even if you are mm-hmm. a specialist, like you could be the, you know, you have to like, okay, you're a specialist on the pandemic. You actually also have to be good for television, you know, or whatnot.
Yes.
And that's just true of, like of so many different jobs right now. And it is something that makes this all very complicated, because some of the reasons that I got into stand-up because I do not like to sit down and fucking write by myself. Like I want to actually
and
be,
now, you're
and
not
now
at
I
night.
Fucking have to stay home, you know, like, and not just this, but also in the world, in the job I created for myself, because, you know.
Cameron. I should write our books.
Great.
And you should go
Sounds
out
great.
And promote
Sounds
them.
Great. Sounds great. You know, when I was, I don't think I've ever said this on the podcast, but it is fucking true. You want to talk about sisters? Okay. I have an older sister who is a lawyer. She, mm-hmm. she also is, she's a modern dancer. When we lived together in Chicago, and she was a lawyer who also worked in corporate America at the time. So she also had her own modern dance company. So one night she would also run lights and sound at my first ever stand-up show, which there was like a ladder and then you couldn't even sit up there. It was not enough room for you to have a chair. So she would just like essentially be on her belly running lights and sound. Then she got up the next morning and audited the Federal Reserve. Is a real thing, you know, like, because she worked at a huge accounting firm. She then made a change in her life and moved into the arts and nonprofit sector. So she now is a high profile arts foundation executive. She runs an arts foundation, and is a lawyer. She's this incredibly impressive person. When I was in grad school, she's a very fast typist. I would dictate my papers to her. I was briefly in grad school. I did not continue. She probably would have ended this relationship. This part of our relationship. But I would pace back and forth. And it was essentially what you and I just did. She said, you know, like, this part, I can do this part. It's very fast. It's honestly better for both of us. You just have to say the paper out loud and I'll write it.
I love that. That's a good story. That is a sister.
This is a sister. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is what it is. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about, because there was a moment in the conversation where you, you know, you were maybe about to use a word to describe yourself, and then you like, I don't even know, you know, and there was a real tossing up of the hands. And what is your feeling there in terms of identity? And if the answer is that it's a tossing up of the hands, what is it like to, you know, take public space and manage that?
Yeah. Well, I can only tell you things that I know. I really only understand my every decade of my life. Like, I can't live my life and understand it at the same time. I have to live some years and then kind of look back and understand them. This is why I write a book every 6 years or so. So I'm assuming I'll have some more clarity on this like next Tuesday. It's like coming. I'm sure it's on its way. But I can only tell you that, you know, in the very beginning, after Abby and I first got together, all anybody ever asked me in an interview or my friends or would say, you know, okay, so like, what are you? And so I used to sit with Abby and say, we are going to figure this out. Like, I need to have an answer. We have to figure out what I am, you know? But I can just tell you some stories. Like, first of all, bisexual doesn't sound right to me because I have to tell you the truth. I never really liked sex with guys. I think I was acting my whole life. Like, I just thought, this is as good as it gets, I guess. It's not really my favorite thing. I don't really understand what the big deal is about, but I guess I'll continue to do it because I used to describe it to my sister as like the oil change of a relationship. Like, you just have to keep doing it so that things keep running smoothly. I know.
Well, Glennon, there's also, so sad. You know, it is heartbreaking. And I just have to say that, like, because we, I have a bunch of friends who, not a bunch, I have several friends who did the marriage to a man, kids, and then realizing what's going on, you know, queer story. But I feel like that story is so unrepresented in queer culture today. Like, we really don't talk about, first of all, that used to be like the only way we had kids or, you know, whatever. We weren't able to adopt. We weren't using sperm donors unless it was like some sort of under the table agreement. Like, that's how we were making families, was that people were having this sort of relationship. And then, and so it's also part of our history, you know, like, this is not some anomaly. It's part of our history that we don't 100% talk about because, like, folks were so shamed, and we didn't necessarily acknowledge the living situations that they were in then when they found out more information about who they were. So it's a part of our history. It was also part of our present that we don't talk about very much, which is this sort of atypically represented, but not atypical story of, like, I'm actually already this person, and then I'm also this person. And I, mm-hmm. Anyway, I just wanted to say, like, I think that this is not such a wild story
because, well, first of all, I think I have some fear. Well, that feels good to me. I mean, I think I have some fear because I don't know how to say this. Like sometimes how I'm not Christian enough for Christian people, I feel like I'm too new to the gay community for, like, there's a lot of, like, you're not a real one of us, you know? And so I get nervous about what words to use and all of that. I mean, I can tell you this story is that last year I was talking to my friend from college and she said, so do you think you were always gay or do you think that you were always? And I said, well, I don't know. I said, I always thought that, you know, women were more attractive than men. And I always thought that like women's bodies are much more attractive than men, but like everyone thinks that. And she was like, no, they don't. She goes, I don't think that. And I was like, what? Like, Kim, seriously. And then I was like, well, this is why we should talk about serious things more. Okay. Because I just thought that clearly everyone felt that way. So I don't know, Cameron. I mean, I grew up Catholic. I grew up in suburban Northern Virginia. I didn't know a single gay person my entire freaking life. I never saw it as an option. I never, you know, this is freaking weird, but I became really severely bulimic when I was 10 years old, like really, really young. And when Abby went to talk to my mom about proposing to me, the first thing my mom burst out crying and she said, Abby, I have not seen my daughter this alive since she was 10 years old. And all I can tell you, I don't know, but I just have this like feeling that there is a lot of things when I was a young kid that I subconsciously knew I couldn't be. And that it made me really sick and really far from myself for a very long time, you know, which is what and maybe this is one of them. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you know that I also had like, I have that experience. I have the actual experience of, using like obsessive and disordered eating to try to transform the body that I didn't understand because it didn't make sense to me what was going on around me. So I understand why that might be a read that you have on that, because that's a read that I have on my own, you know, past. And I will also say that it's, you know, some of what you're talking about, this like litmus text testing for, you know, who gets to be part of the community. It's wild how obsessed with that the queer community is. I will just say we are obsessed with, yesterday or 2 days ago or whatever, there was this like New York Times piece about a bunch of people that claim butch identity. And I posted a bunch of photographs of myself. Mm-hmm. And it was a joke that also, where I also spoke about my own, like I just said, butch, like, I like, this is a feeling that I feel that way. That's a feeling that I feel. And you know who tells me I'm not feminine enough? Everybody, like, just be me walking down the street. But I post this thing where I say that I'm masculine, where like, I claim a sort of butch identity, masculine identity. And a bunch of people were telling me in the, literally, first of all, especially I was TV butch, which like really made me have like a full gasp, because I want to say, if you think that I am TV butch, you should come to Hollywood, because I'll tell you who's TV butch. It is like, who is the most feminine? It is like Anne Hathaway. You know what I mean? Like, it's like somebody that's ever eaten a piece of toast. Like, I just mean like our understanding in Hollywood of like what makes masculinity and femininity is as fucked up as it is everywhere. And our insistence that masculine and femininity, or that personal history, means that we can or can't claim identity is something that we learned elsewhere. And then when we stepped into the queer community, we paused for a tiny second. You know what I'm going to go ahead and bring with me? My need to judge other people and label them. Because I had that before, but I'm going to go ahead and bring it right in here. I just can't leave that at the door. You know? And so, like, I think it's fine. I think it's just fucking fine. If you don't have the answer, if you ever come up with the answer and you want to tell me, if it's
next Tuesday,
you know, next Tuesday, full few decades from now, feel free to text if that feels fun and helpful. But if you don't have any more information, that's fine with me too.
I mean, there's gotta be room for, I don't know, right? Maybe that's a category. Like, maybe that's a thing. I don't know. I don't have an answer. I know, like, that I finally, for the first time, feel that thing that I thought I would never have in my life. That I thought that, I mean, Cameron, I used to say shit like, you know, love is like a light, and some people are laser lovers, and I'm like a floodlight. I just love everyone a little bit. Like that, I never thought that I would. So, I don't know. All I know is that I am so freaking grateful that I get to have this thing, this love thing, and that I'm so freaking grateful that sex makes sense to me now, and that I get it now. And so I know I'm not straight. That's all I know. I'm not straight.
Perfect. What a response to the phrase, I know I'm not straight, by the way, too. I'm like, perfect.
Perfect.
Glennon, it is almost time for us, for me to send you back into your day. I am realizing now I forgot to warn you of this before the thing. So if you need a second, you can let me know. But I always ask our guests to shout out a queero, which is a person, place, or thing that made you feel like you could be who you are today. And if you would like to shout out a queero, I would love to hear it.
Yeah, I would love that. Queero, you're the best. I forgot that word that you use. Well, listen, this is going to sound, I mean, I cannot choose a queero that's not my wife. Like, this is a woman, you know, okay, I'm going to tell you one thing, and this is one thing that I understand about the resentment of people who have been in this community for a long time compared to people like me who, like, just got here yesterday, okay? Because this is a conversation that Abby and I had earlier. She was talking about church shame or something, and I was like, I don't feel any of that. Like, I just feel really confident and free, and, you know, I just don't know why. And she was like, honey, your freedom, okay? Your little freedom that you feel and your shamelessness. There's a lot of people who have been showing up for a lot of decades to earn for you that shamelessness and freedom that you feel right now, right? So, you know, when I think about her being, you know, one of the first out athletes, and, like, you know, people used to scream at her. I mean, I can start crying thinking about it, but, you know, during her college games, people would just scream slurs at her on the field from the first minute to the last minute. Like, it was, and I just, I'm amazed by her, the way that she has shown up for so long, and has kept all of her goodness and sweetness. And yeah, she's for sure my queero.
That's amazing.
100%.
I love that. And you know what else is funny about what you're saying is that I don't think I've ever said before on the podcast, but, like, here's what I'm really thinking about. It's like we have to always, like, look to our queer elders, who sometimes might even be younger than us, who have done fucking the fight. Like, we have to. Like, I really so believe in that. I also think about this, like, I think about it in terms of politics. You know, it's like, we have to absolutely, in my mind, like, look at the folks who, like, knocked down the doors to begin with. And then there's that part of, like, the person who's just coming in now. And, like, of course, like, I just think we always want that person to acknowledge and know the history and, like, you know, but it is also a true gift when people come in and they're, like, they're a fresh perspective, because those are also the people that come in, look around and go, have y'all ever thought of this? And sometimes it gets very annoying, you know, like, I will just say this as me, like, I've been, like, I just been, I, this is not even, this is not directed toward you. It's like toward, like, the, you know, like, I'm been out for 20 years. I look at the young influencer who's like 15 and they're like, I am the fucking queerest queer, you know, like queer. And I'm like, yo, congratulations. And I can get in my own, you know, thing of it. Like, I don't even think you fucking get it, man. When I was 15, I was wearing Steve Madden's, yo. Like, congratulations that you fucking figured it out. I was wearing knee socks, my dude. You know, like, I can get very sort of in the, you know, and I have to just remember it's like, this is also the person who's going to teach you about something about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the person who's and like telling me that like, that like gender norms can go the fuck out the window. Like, I didn't hear that. And sometimes I have to hear that from the newer person to the table. And it just like, if I, you know, if I insist on only looking at our history, which I fucking love to do, then I'm very frequently going to miss the new information that's coming in that applies to me and helps me.
I love that. I love the info of that. I mean, we have it in our house, Cameron, because our son came up to us. Did you know this?
This is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Several months ago. And he's just, I mean, Cameron, this boy, he's so freaking amazing. And he's on fire and he is the gayest gay that ever gayed. And so Abby's just like, fine, you're the expert.
That's part of.
Don't ask me any questions. Not like I have any life experience that can be of use here. Like, that's what it is. And it's so precious and so wonderful. And we want it. But it's the same vibe as, like, you know, in the feminist world, it's like all we do is say women are entitled to a voice. And then, like, these 20-year-olds come and we're like, they're so entitled. Like, and it's like, right? It's like, we've been hazed, so we want them to be hazed. But like the great thing would be is if we just didn't have any of the hazing anymore.
Sure, or just be, you know, like, I'm gonna just for today, I'm gonna let myself be so fucking crotchety if I need to be, and then I'll just like use that till it's been helpful, and then I'll go ahead and put that down. You know what I mean? Like, I'll absolutely, I will be petty if I need to be petty. If my neighbors are playing music again, I will put a speaker in my window playing music back at them, which is something I've done during the pandemic. I will do it. Yes, do it if I need to do it. But then after, I will just go ahead and put that down and I will not continue. You know, just we can.
That feels doable. I like that better. That's good.
Glennon, it is a true pleasure to speak with you, and huge congratulations on the success of Untamed. I am incredibly excited to see its continued success. I know that this has been a really tough time, but it's been incredibly inspiring watching you represent your project and like really with the passion that you have. So thank you for letting us see that, and congrats on the beautiful book.
Thank you, Cameron. Thank you. And congrats on Save Yourself. Ugh. We love you. We love you so much.
Yeah. Love you too.